How does escaping to a remote landscape sound right about now? Coming up, author Pam Petro recommends sites to explore in southern Wales. She points out there's a lot to see, even underground in a coal mine.
You go down in a shaft into utter darkness. You have to leave anything that can make a spark.
A former Peace Corps volunteer tells us about leaving his American life behind for a stint in a totally foreign world. He was assigned to teach English in a town on the vast plains of Central Asia, in Kazakhstan.
And that's what you can experience in Kazakhstan, is that open space.
Author Peter Stark also likes to explore the world's most out-of-the-way places. He tells us how he finds the emptiness of uncivilization can be a transcendent experience.
My entire life, I've been drawn to the most remote places I could find on the face of the globe.
Come with us for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Perhaps you're the kind of person who prefers venturing to places that look fairly empty on the map. Wild adventures far from the maddening crowds are where we're taking you today on Travel with Rick Steves. To be influenced by the open spaces of Kazakhstan, Tibet, Mozambique, and under the midnight sun of Greenland. Let's start the hour enjoying the rugged and enduring landscapes of Wales. Clinging to the west coast of the Isle of Britain and looking out over the Irish Sea is a tiny country called Wales. It's where you can hear one of Europe's oldest languages, encounter more sheep than people, and let your imagination roam wild in green pastures. It's also where American author and creative writing teacher Pamela Petro takes her students every summer, and the place she considers home. Not the home where she lives, but the home where she flourishes. That's a concept the Welsh appreciate and even have a special word for. Pamela's love affair with Wales began over 30 years ago when she was a student herself. Her recent memoir, it's called The Long Field, explores how this little country became a big part of her life, and she's joining us today to share her perfect itinerary in Wales. Pamela, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk about Wales with somebody who really is enthusiastic about Wales, and you even call yourself less than Welsh, but more than American.
That's right. I've been so many times that I feel like Wales has to have rubbed off on me a little bit by now. And I've tried to learn Welsh. I've spent a long time. My Welsh is very bad, but I try.
Well, I'm sure you get a warm welcome when you do speak a little Welsh.
I do.
This is one country that you really feel the pride of its Welshness. I mean, this language was almost gone to extinction, and then it's rebounding, and it's one of the older languages in Europe. It's been a written language, I understand, since, the early Middle Ages.
Yes.
And a lot of people do speak Welsh.
Yes, about 25% of the country is bilingual and speaks Welsh, and Welsh is on the upswing. You can hear it on TV or the radio. Parents are teaching their children. The children are learning in school. It's no longer, in the 19th century, it was looked down upon to speak Welsh. It was not the language of progress. In fact,
right.
Children wore a Welsh knot around their neck, which was a little board on a rope that said Welsh knot. And if you were wearing it at the end of the day, you were beaten and you were given it if you were heard to be speaking Welsh.
Oh, my God. Well, that's just the reality of a small country that is living, within a big country.
Yep.
All over Europe, we have these kind of places, and I think locals call them, we are a nation without a state.
Yes, exactly.
In Wales, they've got a bit of a state, but they're still within Great Britain. And you think about Wales. What I know most about Wales is up in the north where you have this incredible string of castles. It's called the Ring of Iron, and these are not Welsh castles, but they're English castles built by King Edward I about 700 years ago to keep the angry indigenous people down.
Yes.
It's such a powerful heritage. What are your thoughts when you think about the Welsh reality vis-a-vis England?
Oh, I have such a hard time with those castles. They're beautiful. Several together are UNESCO heritage site. And Harlech is a magnificent castle, and so is Conwy and Carnarvon.
Those are many of my favorite castles
know,
in Europe, but I'm aware
fabulous.
That they're bastions of England.
That's right.
In the middle of Wales.
And they're nailing down the authority of the colonists, the colonizer.
Towns, I mean, they're fascinating as far as medieval architecture goes. Garrison towns, you didn't have an airport that would stock your green zone, but you have a port there.
You
and
do.
The boats could come in, and you've got these state-of-the-art castles. but it's all English imperialism.
Indeed.
What is that? You're a lover of Welsh culture. There must be a Welsh castle that is an inspirational place to go to counter all of these English castles.
Oh, yes. In Wales. I have a castle for you and for your listeners out there. Carrig Kennan Castle. It's at the western edge of Brecon Beacons National Park, which itself was just renamed Bainai Brycheiniog National Park, which is the Welsh. It's gone back to the Welsh name. At the very edge on the west, on a precipice overlooking a stream, is a magnificent Welsh castle. It has even tunnels underneath it, and you can rent a torch, a flashlight, and go down into the tunnels and find ancient graffiti down there, people leaving their names in the 15th, 16th century. And that is a Welsh castle. It was taken by the English. It went back to the Welsh, back and forth, until it was destroyed in the Civil War. But that is a place I would go. And it's also in an area that is spectacularly beautiful.
And what area is that again, so we can find it on the map?
Right. This is the western edge of the Brecon Beacons National Park. And the beacons are big, soaring, bald mountains with no trees. They think that in Neolithic and Celtic times, fires were lit as signals on the crests. Mm-hmm. That's why they're called beacons.
I wondered why they're called beacons. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Pamela Petro. She's been traveling to Wales for over 30 years, and every summer she co-directs the Dylan Thomas Summer School at the University of Wales. And her latest book is called The Long Field. It's a memoir using her long connection to Wales as a springboard to explore the concepts of home, of belonging, and loss. Pamela teaches creative writing at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Her home away from home is Wales. Her website is pamelapetro.com. Pamela, when we think of Wales, I think, you know, Cardiff is the capital. It's got a little over 300,000 people. And to me, it's just the quintessential coal port, a reminder of the foundation of Wales' economy in the early industrial age. I mean, what, in 1800, there was 2,000 people in Cardiff, and then suddenly its nickname is Coalopolis. It's the thriving coal port. And then it just coal industry dropped out and it became sort of a depressed place. And it's quite rebounding lately. Have you been to Cardiff recently?
Yes, I have. Cardiff has a fascinating history that it really was one of the world's most multicultural cities around 1900. You could hear all different languages spoken. Hmm. And as the Irish and Scots were coming to America to look for jobs, people were moving to Wales because there was so much work in Cardiff and the mines and the steelworks.
Right.
Today, Cardiff is, I think, one of the great overlooked small cities in Europe, that it's still multicultural. I can think of a terrific Portuguese restaurant right off the bat. There's a medieval castle at its heart. There are beautiful Victorian shopping arcades nearby. And the biggest harbor reclamation project in the 1990s in Europe was in Cardiff. And Cardiff Bay has some of the best architecture I can think of in Britain right now. And it's where the Welsh Assembly is, where Wales rules itself.
A big side trip from there is to a place called the Big Pit National Coal Museum.
Yes, the Big Pit.
Tell us about that.
I take my students down there. What's so wonderful about the Big Pit mine, there are no deep shaft coal mines left in Britain. The miners' strike essentially ended coal mining as we know it in our imagination. That was in 1984-85. The miners who worked at Big Pit are now the tour guides, so they can tell you what it was like. You go down in a shaft into utter darkness. You have to leave anything that can make a spark, car keys, your phone, anything like that, because there's still gas down there that can explode. So it's a little tricky, but it's so evocative of what life was like for coal miners and their families.
And what came out of that was that beautiful choral tradition, I think. Miners got together and sang in their humble lives.
Yes, male voice choirs.
Beautiful dimension of Welsh culture.
Beautifully make the hair raise on the back of your neck. Power and sound.
It's a working man I am, and I didn't have.
Pamela Petro is a visual artist from Northampton, Massachusetts. She teaches creative writing at Smith College and co-directs the Dylan Thomas Summer School at the University of Wales, Trinity St. David. Pam is sharing her love for the nation of Wales with us on Travel with Rick Steves, which she writes about in her book, The Long Field, Wales and the Presence of Absence, a memoir. You can listen to Pam's earlier visit with us on the joys of being Welsh by choice. That's in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. Pamela, we've just got a couple more minutes, and I want to get some advice for you on an itinerary. A highlight, I think, is the southwest tip of Wales, St. David's, and there's a historic pilgrimage there, and you wrote about it really evocatively in your book, The Long Field. Tell us about that medieval pilgrimage route and how you connected all those humble churches and holy wells and carved crosses.
Oh, sure. That was a wonderful journey. Two pilgrimages to St. David's equaled one to Rome, so many people came there from different directions. But I went down the coast, north to south, stopping at these tiny pilgrimage churches, and it was almost as if I were experiencing grace on that journey. If I were lost, someone helped me find my way. If I couldn't get into a church, the warden appeared with a key. It was just, I think of it now and I get chills.
That takes a little time, but it is worth the time to have that experience and do it right. And Pamela, a fascinating point you made in your book is that when you die, you want your ashes buried under the shadow of a certain megalith, a certain 5,000-year-old monument, a stone monument in Wales. Tell us what's special about that.
That is Pentre Ifan. It's a megalithic structure, meaning it's just made of great big stones with three stones holding a giant 17-ton capstone, and it overlooks Cardigan Bay in the Preseli Hills. And the Preseli Hills are where some of the stones of Stonehenge come from. And it's just a place where you can stand and feel rooted to a distant, distant past, which is something I'd sought all my life. And I found it right there in that beautiful landscape of sea and hills and history and prehistory.
You know, you're an unusual, a special traveler who has a real advantage because you have this appetite for not being chronocentric, not looking at things just through the lens of somebody in the 21st century, but getting into the magic of the past. Take a moment, pause, and be there. And as a teacher, you get to share that with your students. That must be so gratifying.
It's wonderful to see students sort of fall out of the present moment and backwards into their imagination. Oh. They're not just connecting with themselves. They're connecting with all the generations who've ever been in this place. It's an honor to be able to introduce them to places like that.
Well, it's been an honor to have a few minutes to talk with you, Pamela Petro, about your book and your love of Wales. Once again, the book is The Long Field, Wales and the Presence of Absence, a memoir. Pamela Petro, diolch for all you offer through your books and through your teaching. Happy travels.
Croeso, Rick. Thank you.
The world's wild and lonesome spaces are calling to us. Up next, we'll hear what 2 years with the Peace Corps in Kazakhstan is like. And later in the hour, adventure writer Peter Stark takes us to magnificent wild places in Mozambique, Tibet, and Greenland. It's Travel with Rick Steves. He was hosted by families of modest means in remote towns that were closed off behind the Iron Curtain less than two decades earlier. Right out of college, Tim Suchland volunteered with the Peace Corps. They sent him to teach English in Kazakhstan. It's the largest of the formerly Soviet bloc countries, known for its wide-open, windy spaces. Tim found that everyday life in Kazakhstan can be something like a madcap tea party, but with vodka. Tim reflects on how volunteering with the Peace Corps opened him up to the world in a memoir he's written called A Five-Finger Feast, 2 Years in Kazakhstan, Lessons from the Peace Corps. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us what the adventure was like. Hey, Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Wow, 2 years in Kazakhstan because you volunteered for the Peace Corps. How'd you end up there?
Well, I was finishing a degree in history and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with that degree. And I had some teachers growing up that I knew had done the Peace Corps and just kept on bringing that to my next steps. And so my senior year, I applied to the Peace Corps and the next summer, I was
being sent
to Kazakhstan.
We'll take you to Kazakhstan. So you don't choose where you're going to go. They tell you where you're going to go?
At least when I was there, it was you had some preferences of regions, and then they took what your experiences were, what your degree was in, and then decided you're going here. And I think it's changed a little bit. You have a little more choice, but at least then that's where I went.
I would think a big part of it is where they think you can contribute and where you would be welcome to contribute.
Yes, exactly. The Peace Corps is only in countries that are invite the Peace Corps there. And so
tell us about Kazakhstan. I mean, I could find it on a map, and I know it's one of the stands.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, stand, that means like where a certain ethnic group lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so the Kazakh, the land of the Kazakhs.
Yes, yeah.
Kazakhstan. What's the demographic thing? What's the cultural makeup? How would you describe the country?
Yeah, of course. It's a former Soviet republic, so gained independence in 1991, and it's literally in the middle of Eurasia. It's a very large country. And to give you an idea of how large it was, we would travel by train to our different Peace Corps sites from the Peace Corps headquarters in a city called Almaty in the south country. And for me to go to my Peace Corps site, it was about 32 hours on the train.
32 hours and still in the same country?
Yeah, and still in the same train, train wagon. Then it was another 2 hours on the bus after I got to the end of the line.
Now, I understand Kazakhstan's one of the wealthier countries of the stands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the basis of its wealth?
A lot of oil money and resource extraction. That's like the biggest industries, and that's what has helped Kazakhstan post-independence gain a lot of that wealth.
In the developing world, it's like there's two kinds of countries, those with oil and those without.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Kazakhstan's got that, so yeah. That helps. And what did you find? I mean, if you lived for 50 years in the Soviet Union, or I don't know how long Kazakhstan was there, but yeah. For generations— what is the heritage of that? What does that saddle the country with today?
Well, it's interesting because I think the Kazakh people they've been around since the Middle Ages, but they've also been influenced by Russians for hundreds of years. And so there's hybrid influences of both Eastern European Russian influence, but then also a Central Asian Turkic sort of influence.
So who would the indigenous people, if you could call it that, be Mongolian or nomads or what?
Yeah, the Kazakh people they lived a nomadic life for centuries. And Russians came in the 1800s, 1700s and set up forts along the way. And when the Soviet Union became what it was, they basically inherited Kazakhstan.
Now, in your book, A Five Finger Feast, you talk about a treasure trove of travel experiences. If you were thinking of going to the stands, which I am, and you were going to go to Kazakhstan, what would I want to do and see there? Why would I want to go there?
So I think the most accessible areas of the country are the two largest cities. So it's Almaty in the south of the country and Astana, which is the capital, kind of the north-central part. Almaty was the former Soviet capital of the country, and so it has a lot of Soviet architecture, but also is a colonial past, so it has old Orthodox churches and mosques, and then it has a really famous bazaar called the Green Bazaar that, as a tourist, it's pretty interesting to see this giant open-air bazaar with butchers and meat and different types of foods to buy, but then also just lots of different trinkets and clothing and stuff. So it's an interesting sort of mix of east meets west.
That's the urban. Mm-hmm. That's the urban thrills in Kazakhstan.
Yeah, and Almaty can feel both very urban and modern because it has a lot of oil money, but it also can sometimes feel like a village because you'd be walking through the city and you come across cottages that are very ornate, kind of in a Russian sort of style.
And you stress in your book the importance of experiencing the bazaar. And I think throughout this part of the world, the bazaar, it's not a museum, it's just a living example of all the commerce and the people and the diversity and everything.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And the bazaar, that's where people shop, that's where they would get their clothing. And
so it's kind of a farmer's market, a flea market, a rummage sale, people putting a blanket on the ground and selling their onions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Some of the most interesting things I saw at the bazaar was a woman selling a sheep's head on a cardboard box. That was... it was pretty fascinating to see that.
I remember that in Russia a lot. They would have these bazaars, and everyone would be different. I mean, there were honey maids that were selling honey.
Yeah.
And I don't know, what are some of the little intimate things? I remember a lady standing there with a gun. She was just selling a gun.
Oh, wow.
She was busy. You want to buy a gun?
Yeah. I think for me, the most interesting things were the food and going through the butcher area, because Kazakhstan loves meat. It's a vegetarian's nightmare for sure, because so much of their food is so reliant on sheep and they eat horse meat. And so just walking through that part of the bazaar was just so fascinating. And then also right next door would be just these colorful different salads that you'd get, Russian salads. There's a salad called Korean salad. There's a number of Korean people who live in Kazakhstan, and it's kind of a kimchi style.
Would that be North Koreans?
It was people who were along the Russian-Korean border who were actually deported by Joseph Stalin.
So it was way back to Stalinistic times.
Yeah, and actually, Kazakhstan's a multi-ethnic country. It's not just the Kazakhs. They are the most ancient and sort of indigenous people of the country, but there's Russians, there's Volga Germans, Armenians, all these different people, and many of them were their great-grandparents were deported there from other parts of the Soviet Union.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Tim Suchlin. And Tim served in the U.S. Peace Corps in Kazakhstan from 2007 to 2009. He was there teaching English. He writes about his experiences in this formerly secretive Soviet society, a society that straddles the line between Europe and Southwest Asia, in his book, A Five-Finger Feast. Today, Tim works as a counselor and an artist in Seattle. His website is timsuchlinart.com, and that's spelled S-U-C-H-S-L-A-N-D. Tim, the book is Five Finger Feast. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I talk a lot about food in my book because it's so important to the culture of Kazakhstan. I mean, it's a connector. It's Kazakhstanis really pride themselves as being hospitable. And so the national dish of Kazakhstan, which is a centerpiece in pretty much every dinner party I went to, any sort of major event, was called beshbarmak, and that actually translates to five fingers. Hmm. And it's a dish that you eat with your hands. It's served out of a central plate on the table, and it's a mix of boiled noodles and some sort of boiled meat. So that could be like horse meat, it could be poultry.
And you eat it with your hand.
Yeah, and that's how they would usually give me a fork when I was...
here's the American, take a fork.
I was the American, but usually you just go in it with your hands, nice greasy mess, yeah.
Was it a single bowl that everybody reached
and
into?
Yeah, everyone's just reaching in for the same bowl.
I've got vivid images in different countries of all these hands going into the food.
Oh, yeah.
And then they look at you like, aren't you hungry?
Yeah, it was an experience. And if you were really lucky, you'd get a boiled sheep head on top of the meal. So, and that was an honor to be able to eat that.
To have the sheep head. Yeah. I want to get into the village where you lived and worked. It was called Yavlenka. Mm-hmm. And you were an English teacher there. And you shared one of your students' videos that she made. Galia was the girl. And you produced it. And what a cool project as a teacher. It was an amazing thing to just watch her proudly show her town off. And, you know, there was military monuments, there were soldiers, there were clunky tin can cars, there was this Soviet architecture, super cheap but still standing. Mm-hmm. She mentioned no running water but a faucet in the street. So people would, they'd be thankful to have a faucet in front of their house where they could go and get their water. Mm-hmm. And everybody had apparently a small garden to grow their own fruits and vegetables. And the luxury in life was a Russian sauna.
Yeah.
That was just fascinating to me to get that little walk through your town by the local student, Galia.
Yeah.
Tell me a little more about what she was sharing.
So there's actually three goals of the Peace Corps, and the third goal is to share with Americans the host country culture. And so we made that video as just a fun sort of let's share the experience of what the village is like. She was one of my better English-speaking students. And yeah, it was a great experience just to make that with her.
It looked like a simple, humble, peaceful, reasonable life.
Yeah, for sure. My village was actually in the very far north, like by the Russian border, and essentially was Siberia. And so a lot of our lives during the winter was inside in our houses and in our places of work. But during the summer, when I actually made that video, they have some of the best summers you could possibly wish for, except for they do have a lot of mosquitoes, which is the one downside. But so, yeah.
In fact, you wrote that. You wrote in your book, at times in Kazakhstan, it feels like a million mosquitoes were biting and feasting on the soul.
Yeah.
That's a pretty graphic way to talk about mosquitoes. If we just think about going to Kazakhstan, by the way, can you just fly? Do you need a visa? Can you just fly in and have a good time?
Yeah. So when I was there, you needed a visa. However, my understanding is they've changed that where you, as an American, can go for up to 30 days and fly into the country and be there for 30 days traveling.
Tim Suchlin works as a counselor and artist in Seattle. He's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to look back on the life-changing perspectives he earned from a stint with the Peace Corps after graduating from the University of Nevada. His book is A Five-Finger Feast, 2 years in Kazakhstan, Lessons from the Peace Corps. Tim, I was fascinated by your description of your hometown while you were there for 2 years. And you mentioned life there was like a lingering 90s sitcom, although with more alcohol consumption.
Yeah.
You said the whole cast of characters was in place. Tell us about the characters that were in place and the alcohol consumption.
Yeah. The cast of characters, I live with a host family for my first year. So I had, a host father, host mother. They were kind of in their late 30s, 40s. And then I had three teenage host siblings I live with. And so my host father was a retired cop. That's one reason probably why he took in a Peace Corps volunteer, partly because I think he was a little bit bored. So there was a lot of antics and interesting sort of things we would talk about. And sometimes we just did not understand each other at all, since my Russian language was not really good and his English was non-existent. And then I had a host brother who, he was just a really gregarious guy and would take me around all over the village, introduce me to everyone. Everyone knew him.
Yeah, you wrote, in the family, we had the goofy yet stern father.
Yes.
The working mom, the funny and silly brother, the comic relief, the brainy older sister and the playful younger sister, loud and obnoxious. Uncle, the loyal dog, and the up-to-no-good school friend, and the friendly neighbor. It does sound like a sitcom ready to be written. And you wrote about going to the local bath with your host father and your host brother as kind of an important Kazakhstan ritual.
Yes, yeah.
You're naked there with them.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, tell me about what you're in the bath. What's going on?
Yeah, so it's called the banya, and it's a wet sauna, essentially. And in most villages and towns and cities, there was a public banya that you could go to and pay for. There's several different rooms, different kind of temperatures, moisture levels.
And so it's quite developed.
Yeah, for sure. And you're essentially trying to get clean because you probably do this about once a week.
So you soak, you get different areas of soaking for steam or heat or plunging in water.
Yep.
And then did he have a masseuse or did he self-exfoliate?
Well, my host father asked me, hey, take this thing and scrub my back.
Oh, so you exfoliated your host father.
Yeah, exactly. And then there would be a room where you sit in this extremely hot room that was so steamy and you just sweat it out. And supposedly it was good for the heart. I don't know the science behind that. And then they would have this thing called the venik, which is a bunch of birch tree branches that you would whip yourself. And it was just stuff that I didn't understand the whole.
So you're rubbing this older man with a Brillo pad.
Exactly.
And then you pick up birch twigs and you start whipping yourself.
Yeah, it's like, what were you doing in the?
And then you wrote, in your book, you wrote, my life had reached a point of no return, all thanks to the simple task of cleaning oneself.
Yes.
So this point of no return, what was that?
At that point, I was immersed in the culture and just had to go with it.
Well, one thing you did understand, I think, was the rules and the art of toasting in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how to do that correctly.
Yeah, so Kazakhstan is heavily influenced by the Russian and Soviet past. And so vodka drinking and things that come with vodka drinking, like toasting, was a big part of the experience. And so if you were at a party, everyone at that party would have a toast. And you would always do the first toast was to the meeting, to the event, I guess. And then the second toast was to friendship. And then the third toast was always to love. And so then you just go around and toast. And you do not interrupt the toaster, that's for sure. I did that a few times, and I got told to stop talking.
So it's quite a strict, stern ritual, it sounds like.
Well, at first it's stern, and then as people start drinking, it loosens up a little bit.
It sounds like you enjoyed being a temporary local. I mean, fascinating story, Tim. And your writing is so fun. You wrote, "This land of vast nothingness is strangely one of the most exotic and beautiful places I've ever encountered in my life." We're out of time now, but can you just capture that wonder that you mentioned there, one of the most exotic and beautiful places you've ever encountered. Is there one experience or image that you could share with us so we just have a better appreciation of why we might want to actually visit Kazakhstan someday?
Well, most of Kazakhstan is flat steppe. So if you imagine like the Dakotas or eastern Colorado, but in the second year of my service, I went camping with some other Peace Corps volunteers and just being out on this open space. There were, scattered forests around, and there was really not that many people within hundreds of miles from where we were. And that's what you can experience in Kazakhstan, is that open space, because it's so large and there's not that many people who live there.
It's landlocked.
Yeah, it's landlocked, yeah.
So you can take a 32-hour train ride and still be in the same country.
And that was the longest train ride.
That is reason enough right there to dream about going to Kazakhstan. Tim Suchland, thanks so much, and best wishes with your book, A Five Finger Feast.
Thank you for having me.
Author Peter Stark tells us about his experiences in some of the most sublime, empty places around the world in just a moment. What kind of landscapes have your travels taken you to lately? Share your impressions in the form of a haiku poem, and we might read them on the show someday. Here is a few travel haiku our listeners wrote that we thought you'd enjoy.
Tracy Lynn of Charlottesville, Virginia, writes us this about white nights of summer in the far north of Russia. St. Petersburg, June. Endless daylight glistens off endless golden domes. Chantal Rev from Jersey City, New Jersey, writes this haiku for us of a scene she observed in Japan. Neon Tokyo rain blurs footage of their blind date. Wave, kiss. Flirt, debate. And Patricia Castle from Waikoloa, Hawaii, writes this about what she saw on the back roads of Ireland. Tufts of creamy wool caught on splintery fence rails, far from Irish looms. Share your travel impressions with us in a haiku poem. There's a link for sending us yours in the radio section of ricksteves.com.
Have you ever looked out the window on a flight and wondered about those long stretches of land that appear to be almost uninhabited? At night, it's total blackness. On the ground, the world may seem like it's teeming with cities and traffic and connected by a circuit board of highways and roads that all seem to lead somewhere. But it's not actually that way. Explorer Peter Stark joins us with a bird's-eye view at some of those seemingly empty places on the globe, places that have their own histories of settlement and abandonment. In his book, The Last Empty Places, A Journey Through Blank Spots on the American Map, Stark explores these blank spots in America. But he's traveled the world from Greenland to Manchuria in search of real wilderness as well. And he joins us today to share what he's learned. Peter, thanks for joining us for a visit to some of these very desolate places.
Well, I'm delighted to talk about this with you, Rick. It's so fun.
Did you just think, hey, my last name is Stark, I think I'm going to focus on Stark places?
That probably had something to do with it. And also my upbringing. I came from a very adventurous family who did crazy outdoor stuff. That helped too.
Because there is Stark stuff on this planet that a lot of people jump over or fly over or avoid, and there's a lot hiding out there, and it's worth checking out. So you started in America. How did you end up, first of all, interested in empty places, and then how did that end up taking you globally?
Well, it's really been a passion of mine since I think I was a small boy, and it might have been partly my father was really into frontier history in Wisconsin, and so I learned a lot about Indian tribes and indigenous people. And as I grew older and I eventually got into towards reading and writing and journalism, I developed this passion of going to find these places and going to find places where people still lived in a very traditional way, and in a way that I didn't feel had been homogenized by Westernization. I mean, before I became a journalist, it was a passion, a driving passion of mine. And so my entire life, I've been drawn to the most remote places I could find on the face of the globe. And so what you're talking about is a few of those places where I ended up in the course of many, many years of travel.
It seems like all travel writers and travelers like to do is find places that have sort of missed the modern boat. You can go to remote places. You can go to vast, empty places. Is there a sense that the people you encounter, the little villages you encounter, the towns, the crossroads in these most uninhabited corners, that they are somehow behind the rapid change of pace on this planet?
That would certainly be one way of looking at it, that they're behind the rapid pace of change on the planet. Another way to look at it is they're way ahead of the rapid pace of change. that they have ways, life ways, if you want to call it that, that have been tested for thousands of years and have sustained a social fabric and a way of life, and that they're stable communities and they're, you know, healthy people and they're emotionally connected in a way that maybe the modern world isn't so much.
So we could learn from them. We could be inspired by them. You wrote in your book, The Last Empty Places, that the compulsion to seek out the wild secret places, the blank spots, never left me, but has only grown stronger. And with time and age and resources, it extended over a greater geographical range, as it did for John Muir and Henry David Thoreau. The search has taken me over the decades to wild, empty regions of Africa, to the hidden valleys of Tibet, to the ice fields of Greenland, and the forests of Manchuria and many places in between. Let's talk about some of those places. What was your experience in Africa? I think of Africa as teeming with people. Tell us about empty Africa.
Well, there, just as there are in the United States and anywhere in the world, there are places in Africa that are not teeming with people. And northern Mozambique is one of those places. It's remarkably uninhabited. It's a huge stretch of forest. They call it Miombo Forest. So it's like a kind of an open forest. And I was invited to go on a exploratory kayak expedition down the Lugenda River, which is 750 kilometers long and had never been paddled in its length, I don't think by native people or any Westerners. And so we were on this tiny kayak expedition, and it was, I mean, it was like everything you could ever want and way more than I wanted in an African exploration. It was literally what early explorers must have felt like. I mean, that's the first time and only time I really felt that. You have no idea. You're going, you know, through this jungly river, vines hanging, you're in a little kayak and you're going around a river bend. The water's going fast. You have no idea what's around that river bend. And sometimes it was a waterfall. And sometimes you'd almost go over that waterfall. Other times you'd come around a river bend, there'd be a pod of hippos, which people or African visitors know are they're the most dangerous animal in Africa, because when the males are extremely territorial and they'll just crush a canoe, a native canoe, not to mention a foreigner's kayak, they just crush it between their teeth. Or, you know, crocs are diving off the banks. So the times that we flipped over, which I did a number of times, I mean, it's like you're literally swimming with the crocs. And halfway down that, and plus there were the rapids, not to mention the rapids, you know, which we got worse and worse and worse as we went down. And there are no villages.
You probably didn't have a guidebook that says this is a level three or whatever. So you didn't know what was around the corner, and there's no 911. You're off the grid. There's no way to get help.
You know, it was one of the times in the world where you realize there are no jet planes flying over here. Oh, it's nothing. Wow. It's just silence, and remarkably remote.
Yeah.
And then stars, incredible stars. And not only stars, but then you're like washing the dishes at night in the river. And there are two of you have to do it. And one of you is shining a headlamp out into the water so you can see the double red eyes of the crocodiles coming towards you on the riverbank. And because they'll pull you right off the riverbank into the water.
So there are places in Africa where you are in the minority when it comes to the animal kingdom.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I would have bailed out halfway down that trip after some serious swims through rapids if I could, but I realized that if I bailed out, you know, there's like no exit. There's nowhere to go. You can walk through the woods for the next 3 weeks by yourself.
Well, I'm glad you're okay. Tell us about your experience in the hidden valleys of Tibet.
Well, and that's another, that was one of the, all of these were such highlights of my life. And I mean, that just, it kind of brings tears to my eyes, that part of the world that I had this crazy idea after Amy and I were first married about, it was kind of a honeymoon trip following the length of the Yangtze River from its source on the Tibetan Plateau all the way down to Shanghai, which is thousands of miles. So for the first month of that, we managed with a great deal of difficulty and expense to hire Tibetan nomads and some Chinese guides to take us through these very remote valleys of the Tibetan Plateau in Qinghai province, right outside of Tibet proper. And it was a totally traditional nomadic Tibetan lifestyle that we were just walking right through for weeks and weeks and greeted so hospitably at these big woven wool black nomad tents and put down on sheepskins in front and serve bowls of steaming yak milk with just endless, endless mountains all around us and prayer flags flapping in the winds. It was incredible.
When it comes to travel experiences like that, I feel like an amazing homebody. I mean, these are options that people can have.
Adventure writer and historian Peter Stark is helping us explore the beauty of the world's more remote and unpopulated spaces right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Peter writes about wilderness survival for Outside Magazine and visits remote corners of America in his book, The Last Empty Places. He also writes about George Washington, the history of Astoria, Oregon, and recounts the rivalry between William Henry Harrison and Chief Tecumseh in Gallop Toward the Sun. Peter's joining us from his home in Montana.
Okay, well, take us now to Greenland, because Greenland is in the news lately because of climate change and the melting ice cap. More and more of Greenland is green. What was your experience in Greenland?
Well, even though it is melting, there's still a lot of it that's not green.
Yeah.
A lot of it. And we were in that part. I had this crazy idea. I was writing a lot for Outside Magazine then, which was still pretty new, and interest of the magazine was interested in doing crazy things. And so I came up with this crazy idea. I called it Driving to Greenland. And the idea was to get in a car, in this case, my father-in-law's VW van here in Missoula, Montana, and drive straight north on US Highway 93 and keep driving until we came to the end of the road, and then trying to keep going after that. You know, and I'd done a little homework ahead of time, but, you know, it was still kind of like launching into who knows what. So we ended up, you know, it was like a 5-day drive in the VW van up to Yellowknife in Northwest Territories. And then we managed to get little commercial flights kind of across the Arctic. We ended up in Baffin Island. Then we ended up hitchhiking on this bush plane that had been hired by this wealthy German couple because the woman was a landscape painter. And so they were chartering this little tiny plane to go up to Ellesmere Island. And Ellesmere Island, you know, if you know your Arctic history, that's the end of the road in Canada. I mean, there's no road. It's the end of everything, the end of the land in Canada. That was like the jumping off place for the North Pole, you know, for the explorations of the North Pole. And then once we got into there's a little tiny landing strip, Inuit village called Grise Fjord in southern Ellesmere Island. And we left the German couple there and for a few hours, supposedly. And Amy and I had hired the pilot, the French-Canadian pilot, to fly from Ellesmere Island over to Greenland. And, you know, at that point, the globe is kind of everything's getting closer together as you're that far north on the globe. And so Greenland is only like 200 miles away from Canada. So we took this little plane with this pilot, Jacques, and this is in early 90s. So GPS doesn't exist. No magnetic compass works up that far north. And so we're like partway, you know, like we're about an hour into this flight and over this beautiful icy blue waters down below and mountain icebergs poking up everywhere. And I'm sitting in the front seat and Jacques takes this map that he has in his lap. It's a big paper map. And he just kind of bundles it in a wad and shoves it in my lap. See if he can figure out where we are. and, you know, here we are flying over the Arctic Ocean, somewhere between Greenland and Canada. We designated trying to get to the farthest north cluster of villages in the world, at a place called Kanak in northern Greenland.
What was it like to be in a desolate spot in the ice fields of Greenland?
Well, and then we ran into, after we had kind of a problem crash landing, landing gear broke off on the airplane when we landed on the tundra, but then we ended up getting hooked up with traditional Inuit hunters who took us out by dog sled onto the sea ice to hunt narwhals, which they did with kayaks and harpoons in a very traditional way. And so being way, way, way out on camping on the sea ice with traditional Inuit hunters was an extraordinary experience.
We're considering the value of the world's most remote landscapes on Travel with Rick Steves with author and adventurer Peter Stark. Peter explores the empty parts of Maine, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and New Mexico in his book, The Last Empty Places. His website is peterstarkauthor.com.
Peter, just try to capture in one of these places the tranquility, the desolation, the smallness of you under a vast sky, the silence. Take a moment, just one place in all of your travels where you were alone with creation in a way that changed you.
that experience on the ice fields would be a good one, even though, you know, we had Inuit hunters with us, just a few, or a little tiny party. But this was July, and so it's the height of the Arctic summer. And so there were no stars at night. In fact, the sun shone all night long, and the sun would just circle around the horizon. And at midnight, 4 a.m, it would dip a little near the horizon, but it's still, there's ice and broken ice everywhere. And we're camped out there. And the Inuit are like playing cards all night to pass the time. And that's what they do in these little villages in the summer. They're just up all night long playing cards. And time does not exist. It does not exist. And in fact, I wrote a little essay for the New Yorker, the Talk of the Town, about this profound experience. Hmm. I had this vision that when you're here, this thing that we call hours and days and minutes, it doesn't exist. And we chop our lives into these pieces of schedule. It's like this rigid structure. It doesn't exist up there. And it's the rhythm of the seasons and the rhythm of the weather. And you are totally in the Arctic. It's so extreme. You're totally subject to that all the time. And so it's like with these hunters, nothing would happen for several days. And all of a sudden they say, okay, let's go. We're going. Pack up right now. Because like the ice is moving. Something's breaking. Something's moving out. Wow. The big storm's coming. It's like there's no planning. You just go.
Yeah, you don't set the alarm clock. The alarm clock.
You don't set the alarm clock.
You know, that is so fundamental. And in the United States, we're the opposite extreme of that as a society that thinks of time as money. You know, we're just trained. We bank it. We spend it. We invest it. We save it. We waste it. It's like a commodity. Different societies are different that way. That was why I had more culture shock in India than in other places, is just because the notion of time in India, time's like bubblegum, you know, you just play with it. And when you're sitting on an ice cap, you're just waiting for the ice to start moving, but you don't need a watch for that.
Yeah, man. I can see totally when you're talking about India. Yeah. I mean, I've traveled there a little bit, but I totally understand. Yeah. It's not this rigid system that we create here in the West.
Now, you know, I know from reading through your book, The Last Empty Places, that you were inspired by the great transcendentalist thinkers like Emerson and Thoreau. What is transcendentalism, and how does that factor into your passion for empty places?
Those thinkers were really, I guess, prevalent in the early 1800s. And in part, they grew out of the Romantic movement of the late 1700s and early 1800s. And the Romantic movement was this, at this time, is kind of a transition in Western society when, as industrialization encroached, nature, you know, the natural world started to disappear, and it started to be considered more valuable. And it became a place of beauty rather than fear and terror. The mountains became a place of beauty in many eyes. And so out of that romantic strain came these transcendentalists who began to look at nature as a spiritual place and a sort of uncivilized nature, wild nature, as having spiritual value. Then you get Emerson's and the Thoreau's, and Thoreau, of course, lived it at Walden Pond, even though he was like 2 miles from Concord, Massachusetts. But, you know, he embraced that concept.
You can have that by flying all the way to Greenland, or you can have it by having your own Walden Pond. It's just, it might be, you don't have many options when you're in Greenland because you're surrounded by nothingness. And in Walden Pond, you've got a mall just down the street. But you can benefit from that. That's this whole notion.
Exactly.
There's more to life than increasing its speed. And
exactly.
Well-being is not necessarily preceded by material in a hyphen. What's the takeaway from all of this? I think Thoreau wrote, to live deep and suck the marrow out of life. You know, he said, we're not looking at nature. We are nature looking into nature. This is fascinating, radical stuff. And it's almost subversive for an American to think this way these days. It's dangerous.
It could be dangerous. Well, I tell people, you know, as you say, you don't have to go to the Arctic. You can have an adventure in your own backyard. And with kids, I mean, you can really have an adventure with your own backyard. And I think a lot of it, as you're saying, you know, when Thoreau talks about sucking the marrow out of the bones of life, it's living in that moment and sort of rejecting the notion of time that we've just been talking about. And it's living in that immediacy of things are here and things are alive and I'm here and I'm alive. And in our society, a lot of what that takes is to get away from human constructs and human busyness. Just before we started this talk, I was walking around in our North Hills here in Missoula. I didn't see a person. I was with our black lab. And, it's just this incredibly soothing moment for me to do that.
And you could probably live any number of places. And you've chosen to live in Missoula as a kind of Walden Pond, I would imagine.
It is kind of, yes, you are right. Yeah, very good.
Well, this is Travel with Rick Steves, and we have sure enjoyed you taking us to places that we wouldn't find in a guidebook, places that you don't need a reservation. You won't find a nice hotel to go to put your head on a pillow at night, but you sure can find a transformational experience. And we need that more than ever these days. Peter Stark, thanks for joining us, and happy,
thank you, Rick.
Happy transcendental travels.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kasmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Rick Steves Classroom Europe is a fast, free, and fun video archive. It's designed for teachers, travelers, and students. It gives you immediate access to some 500 short video clips from the Rick Steves Europe TV show library. Clips cover European history, art, culture, food, and geography. Google Classroom Europe or visit ricksteves.com to watch clips and create your own playlist. Teachers love it. Students do, too.